Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to a very special Art Detective. You might be able to hear from my voice that I've had some wine. I am in the Turf Tavern, which is a wonderful pub in Oxford, near to the Bridge of Sighs, near to the Bodleian Library, a copy of every book ever published, and the Sheldonian Theatre, designed by Christopher Wren. But this pub is most famous, probably, for Inspector Morse. He used to drink in here, and it was part of the inspiration for why I wanted to go to Oxford University, that I decided to watch Morse and come here. I am already drunk, as you can tell. This is a drunk art detective. It's only for the Patreon subscribers. It's very secret. It's very naughty. But I have my very dear friend, Adam Rutherford, in front of me. Adam Rutherford in front of me.
So dear, you can just about pronounce my surname.
Oh my God. So we are here because the Oxford Literary Festival is taking place, and you spoke tonight in the Martin Lecture Theatre.
Yes.
About your new book. Tell the art detective listeners what you spoke about.
Well, you know, because you came to
that
talk.
No, I was late.
No, you turned up. You turned up just as I'd finished. Well, I was talking about what it means to be human from a scientific perspective, from an evolutionary biology perspective, and I did talk a lot about art because the start of that talk is about the first depictions of what we can unequivocally describe as artistic, which occur around about, well, for Homo sapiens, around about 40,000 years ago until about last year in Germany exclusively, the Löwenmensch of Hohenstein this is where a bottle of wine gets in the way. Hohenstein
Come on, Adam, you can do this. It's called the Lion Man.
The Lion Man. Löwenmensch of Hohenstein Stadel. Mm. Thank you. God, that took a couple of days to get out. Which is this amazing carved tusk.
Incidentally, Art Detective listeners, I am making an entire BBC one-hour documentary on this particular artwork.
It is stunning. I mean, it's a stunning piece of work.
Incredibly important because it heralds give us the dates.
So it's 40,000 years old.
40,000 years old.
Yeah, and it was found in Germany in the 1930s, and it was the earliest depiction of figurative art by Homo sapiens until about 2 years ago.
Oh dear.
No, in fact, not 2 years ago, last year. 2018, or autumn 2018. We'll come to that in a minute. But the point is that it's figurative in the sense that it's not a cave painting, it's a tusk, it's carved out of a...
it's a piece of tusk that has been carved. It's about, 12 inches high?
It's about 12 inches high, and it's a man's body. There's been a lot of debate over the years about
whether it has genitals.
They think that the best guesses are it has genitals and they're male genitals. It has seven stripes down its arm,
yes,
which people have suggested are tattoos. We know that tattooing kits existed back in those days.
I mean, we're talking 40,000 years ago. This is a pivotal moment in terms of how art evolves, because what it's really doing is showing that human beings, or Homo sapiens, or however you scientists like to refer to them, could extrapolate their own existence into a fantasy realm. They could create a hybrid, couldn't they?
So in scientific terms, what we talk about is that this is the earliest example of what we refer to as behavioural modernity.
Behavioural modernity, I like that.
Yeah, so these are behaviours that are not... that are indistinguishable from behaviours that we see today. And so just that one figure, the fact that it is the body of a man with a cave lion's head, says just that on its own says a bunch of stuff. It says that we're capable at this point in time of creating very complex, sophisticated artworks.
Yeah.
And I'm unequivocal about describing it as art.
Oh God, it is art. It is, isn't it? Because
well, not everyone within my field is.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So what do they say?
Well, it's an architect. It's an
archaeological
artifact. Yeah.
Because it's found in a
collection. It's fucking art. Are we allowed to swear on this?
Yes.
It's fucking art, man.
It's found in a collection of objects, isn't it? There's other things around it, beads and other.
It's the oldest of that find. It was found in a cubby hole in a particular cave in Hohenstein-Stadel. Got it right that time.
Well done.
Thank you. I'm pleased with that. But it is the body of a man, and it's the head of a cave lion, and it has these sort of stripes, these indicative stripes down its arm. And the inferences we can draw from the fact that it exists are hugely significant in our understanding of human evolution, because the fact is that human bodies, physiology, and also human genetics hasn't really fundamentally changed for more than a quarter of a million years. And if you met someone who was transported through time a quarter of a million years ago to now, they wouldn't be physically different from us. If you tidied them up, gave them a shave, or put them in clothes, you'd meet them now in this pub, and you wouldn't notice that they were different.
No, I think the thing that really excites me about objects like that is genuinely that they are... an attempt at making art. They're an attempt at getting outside of the day-to-day, because we both love Lascaux, we both love prehistoric paintings, the hand sprays, the handprints, all these things that are echoes of a human being imprinting themselves on the world.
Yeah.
That's all great, but what's different with this particular example with Lyman is that he is a fantastical creation. He is something that only the imagination can make, and surely that's the origins of art.
Well, he's the earliest, and that's the key point. He was the earliest until last year, and I'll come to that in a minute. But he is the thing. Yeah, there aren't any significant examples of that level of abstraction or abstract thought or creativity.
Exactly, abstract thought. Yeah.
Earlier than 40,000 years ago in Europe, and therefore represents a huge transition in behavioural. Behaviour.
Thank you. This is Drunk Art Detective Friends.
That's the wine kicks in.
You did well. Yeah,
behaviour. and so you don't see that in the archaeological record before that.
Yeah.
We see sophisticated tool use, but it's sporadic. You see evidence of non-functional coding of things in stones, maybe as early as 90,000 years ago, particularly in South Africa, in the Blombos Caves. But this is unequivocal. It's an unequivocal demonstration of modern behavioural modernity in the way that the mind that was behind that was not distinguishable from the minds that we have today.
I agree. And I think that, when we look at something like a Dali, or when we look at any of the artworks that morphs reality with the unreal, we've got the origins of it with this piece, haven't we?
I don't think we do, actually. I don't think we do. We've got the origins. And there's a really specific reason for that, which is that although it's the only example we have from Europe at that time.
Well, if it's one, there must be more.
Exactly. It's
part
of a continuation.
Yes.
Right?
How interesting.
It cannot be unique. But those things are either lost to time or we haven't found them yet.
I agree.
But the point is that we don't find anything significant like that in the archaeological record before 40,000 years ago in Europe.
So, and in terms of how the thing's found, it's found in this very contained space, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's down in south east or west Germany, I can't remember now, because we're two bottles in. It's definitely in South Germany.
It's in Germany.
Yeah, definitely in Germany.
No, it's in Germany.
but that's an important point as well, because the Lion Man was found in the 1930s. and dated later and continually dated since. And 40,000, I think, is a reasonable dating for it. Because these techniques develop as science develops, right?
Of course, yeah.
But, and we got a bunch of stuff from after that, meaning more recently than that, and we've got the, you know, the Lascaux cave paintings in the sort of 20s to 30,000 years ago. There's also the Venus figurines, and the oldest of which is
I wanted to ask you about the
yep.
Venus figurines.
Yep.
I mean, it's difficult because I want to jump from Lyman to Venus.
Well, the oldest Venus is Holy Fells, and that's the oldest date for Holy Fells is 38,000 years.
38,000.
Yeah, and it's something like 20 miles from Hohenstein-Stadel.
Yeah, exactly. They're really close to each other.
Yeah.
And there's a
bunch of stuff going on down in there at that time.
Yeah, and I think it's all about artistic expression, isn't it? Expression, isn't it? I think that what's happening with the Lion Man is a manifestation of abstract thought. But then when you get to the Venus figurines, that's an abstraction too, isn't it? Because they have the elements of a woman, but they're not realistically rendered, are they?
No, very, very much not.
Those boobs!
Well, that is a source of a lot of speculation in interpretation of what these figures are. So
yeah.
the earliest one is Holy Fells, and that's about 38,000 years ago, and there's I don't know, 7 or 8 of these figures, and they range over 38 to in the 20,000 years. The first one was called the Venus Impudique,
exactly,
and it was named by, I forget the guy's name,
a man,
a French aristocrat,
and it's Monsignor.
No, I don't know, it's in the book and I can't remember because he was a French aristocrat.
Okay.
And I've had too many drinks now. But it's got a very, very clear, a sort of exaggerated vulva.
Yes.
And for that reason, he referred to it as the Venus Impudique.
Impudique, exactly,
right.
Which is, yeah, improper. Or,
so we call them Venuses from that point forward. And
the whole Venus concept is flawed, isn't it?
Well, they're women, and their depictions of the physical form, and they are women. They almost all have exaggerated sexual characteristics.
The labia on the
labia or
example
boobs.
We're talking about.
Right,
yeah.
So the Venus Impudique has very prominent vulva. The Venus of Holy Fells has what scientists colloquially refer to as enormous knockers.
Enormous knockers. Massive knockers. Bigger than the invisible head that is not there.
Yeah, it has a tiny head.
Tiny head.
But all of these things are interesting from
yes,
an interpretive
totally.
Point of view, not because of what... I'm really specific about this in the book, because a ton of research has been published about these figures over
yeah.
the years. And I think most of it is bollocks.
Yeah.
Because they say things like, well, you know, there's interpretations about the fact that the Venus of Holy Fells' head is tiny.
Yeah.
And then suggest that the reason that the Venus of Holy Fells is tiny, has a tiny head but enormous boobs is because...
They're looking down at their body. Is that
right.
the one you're thinking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
I got that as not a historian. It's not a historian. It's imprinted into me. The reason the Venus bodies look like they do is because they're carved by women looking down at their own physique.
Yeah.
And I've always struggled with that.
Well, it only works, really, if you're the only,
woman
who exists.
Yeah, the only person in the room.
Because I can look at you. I can look down at myself and I've got all sorts of, you know, body disproportion issues going on.
Yeah.
But also there's a bunch of people in the pub, right? And I can look at them and think, well, their heads are normal size, so I'm not really buying that as an argument.
Yeah.
Also, the Venus of Willendorf has not only a normal-sized head and massive boobs, but I'm not sure massive boobs is a scientifically correct term.
It's okay, we can work with it.
But she's also got a normal-sized head.
She has got, like, disproportionately enormous boobs. And one of the things I was weaned on as an early art historian was to look at these prehistoric female figures as self-portraits, which also brings into the question the whole issue of female artists, female carvers, female creators, which I think was an early feminist move to sort of say, you know, even 40,000 BC, women were carving their own bodies, women were carving their own impression. But actually, what you say in your book is that it's probably totemic or it's forming some sort of a talismanic process.
Do you know what? It's not even that.
Okay.
And because I have to be scientifically rigorous about this. And one of my key influences
can I
on this...
Can I just say, Art Detective listeners, I think we're making amazing sense given the amount that we've drunk.
One of my main influences on this is our mutual friend Alice Roberts, who did the illustrations for this book. Because she says very... And I think it's absolutely correct that... the truth of the matter is, we got no fucking idea what people were thinking when they were carving this stuff. And to my mind, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Right? Because what's important to me is that it shows behavioural modernity in the sense of abstraction of thought,
yeah.
depiction of bodies, either female or male. Maybe they were totemic in terms of reproduction. But the fact of the matter is, I look at you across the table now, and I've got no idea what you're thinking. And I can speculate about it, but I don't know. So why the fuck would we know what someone who died 40,000 years ago was thinking when they were carving a Venus or the Lion Man?
Well, this
that doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that it shows that they were having thoughts that were recognisable.
Yeah, totally. And I think that this is one of the things I love being friends with you, Adam, is that, you know, I'm a person steeped in the humanities. I'm steeped in literature and music and art. But my passions lie deep in the sciences too. And actually, I think what we do a disservice to ourselves as in the modern age is to sort of think that an object like that needs to be seen either as a archaeological artifact or something scientific or something that needs, or possibly an artwork. And then these dialogues take place where nobody's talking to each other, nobody's sharing their information or their ideas. That's a modern phenomenon, isn't it?
So I've got to be really parsimonious about this because that is
parsimonious, good word.
That's my cultural background. It's a good word to get out when you've had two bottles
I'm impressed.
Of Chardonnay that we've just had. But that's my, you know, that is my natural disposition, and that's my scientific disposition as well, which is to say, I want to extract the simplest information about what we can discern from this real phenomenon. You know, speculation about what those things are is fun and it's interesting, but the truth is, like, maybe the Venus was a toy.
Maybe it was a doll. Thing, isn't it?
Maybe it was pornography. We just don't know.
But she also says that we ignore children in the prehistoric age.
Yeah.
And possibly it's a fun doll. It's a doll. I mean, God, maybe it's a doll.
Right. I mean, in
and maybe the Lion Man is a toy.
In 40,000 years' time, if you dug up, if there was only one Barbie left in the whole of the archaeological record, you dig that up and think,
"Wow, this is the representation of the female."
Christ alive! Look at the proportions on that.
Yeah,
what were they thinking then? It's a doll. It's a massive misrepresentation. But the point is, and the point is for scientific purposes, it shows the mind behind that.
Yeah.
It demonstrates that the mind behind that was not significantly different to our own. It was interpretive. It was it was capable of creative processes. It was capable of other things that I've just
forgotten
what they were. But
abstraction.
Right?
And as a scientist, looking at human beings from that period, do you think that something like the Lion Man or the Venus is a useful scientific tool? Does it help us to understand the people that lived at that time? That was a good question.
It was not bad, actually. I'm really impressed.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a good question. I'm proud of myself.
Yeah, it does. It does, because we don't see that level of behavioural modernity earlier than that. And that's the key thing. I don't care what it represented. I do, but from a purely scientific point of view, all I care is that it shows a line in the sand which says, before this, people weren't doing it.
Yeah.
After it, they were, and they were doing it everywhere.
Yeah.
They're doing it all over Europe. They're doing it in Indonesia.
And splashing it over caves and creating spaces that were... I mean, we think things like tourism and the idea of the pull of the place is a modern phenomenon. It's not at all. I mean, the idea that a space could have artworks in it that other people from a prehistoric era could actually go and visit and see... I think we forget that might have been attractive then too.
Well, again, I've got no idea why they did this stuff.
Yeah.
And we can fondly and usefully speculate about what they were for. They clearly had some cultural purpose.
Yeah.
Right, or else you wouldn't do it.
Do you think there is a... I mean, this is a completely abstract thought, but in terms of when Homo sapiens start to... create the sense of communities, of villages, of identity. Do you think the art is an expression of that? Do you think it is a sense of identity?
I'm super reluctant to commit to any of these kind of ideas, because all of these types of conversations are inherently framed by contemporary understanding of what we're talking about. So those terms like villages and communities, right?
They're modern phenomena.
They're almost meaningless in a prehistorical context, yes, we are a social organism, but we've been a social organism for millions of years rather than hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of years. We are inherently and have been for hundreds of thousands of years, you know, genetically bound to other members of the same species in both families and wider communities. But those things are, you know, these are, the problem, there's a big semantic problem here, right? We talk about migration.
Yes, right, come right? on.
Migration is a huge issue. Okay. That is like the defining issue of how Homo sapiens is spread around the world.
Yeah.
Right?
And you and I are both products of that entire
right,
system.
But in entirely different ways.
No, exactly.
And so when we talk about migration in the modern age, and we're talking about, you know, people from Syria turning up in Italian coastlines, or in our generation coming from Poland or Guyana or whatever it is, right? What we're talking about in terms of human migration over evolutionary time spans is small populations migrating at the rate of about a mile every 1,000 years.
Really? Is that how it works out?
It's stuff
it's a
like
boat
that.
That brings humans to a place, isn't it? That's how we have to think about it in a kind of
so we draw these maps. We draw these maps which say we started off as an African species and we are an African species.
Yep.
And over the course of the last 80,000 years or so, we've populated every corner of the world, right? 80,000 years is 12 times longer than the entirety of human history.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I'm a historian, and the frustration of endpoints is well, intense.
Fucking hell, we can't agree what happened during the Iraq War.
I know.
Which was in the age of the internet. Right?
Well, we have source material coming out of our ears, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we've got the opposite problem 10,000 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or 100,000 years ago, which is we got. It is opinion rich data poor.
But it is. Opinion rich data poor. It's, so,
it's a useful phrase, that, isn't
it's
it?
It's so funny. So I've been working on the Olmecs, who are about 1,000 BC. And to find two people that agree about how they use their space, how they interacted, what their sort of spiritual framework was, you just, it's so fabricated, isn't it? I mean, it kind of makes me feel slightly redundant as a historian that how do I ever give people answers when humanity is so diverse and complex, and you do it from a scientific point of view, which is
well,
to say there are answers.
I don't do that at all. I don't. I really
no,
don't.
No, Nina. I do not do that. Well, what the hell are
well,
you
okay,
saying?
I'm going to disagree with you twice now.
Thank you.
Right, the first is that I think that history done well is a science.
Okay.
Because it's evidence-based.
Wow, excellent. Okay, good.
And I understand that it's not as precise a science as molecular biology or fucking physics.
Yeah.
Right, but. Both of them are quite boring.
It's not slides on a microscope.
Well, but it is, though, because it's become that.
I agree. And I actually think that what the really good historian could do is analyse to a point that nobody
else has. It's data. Look,
yeah.
It's data. It's fucking data.
Yeah.
And the question is whether you, how hard you stick to what the data can tell you. And I think the fundamental difference between good history and historical sciences is the point, and this is where me and you will always diverge a little bit, but not really that much, is the extrapolations you can go. This is what this is what the data is.
Yes.
And then you say, well, what does the data say?
Yeah.
And those two things are different. And, you know,
what does the data say? But, I mean that's so open to interpretation,
isn't
it?
Yeah, of course it is, yeah.
Because, you know, you and I have had this conversation many times before, but my opinion of studying the humanities is it's endless variety. It's endless opportunity for surprise and for... Yeah, you know, the complexity of the human being to just throw something completely sideways that you can't bundle people together.
Well, yes, but it's. I think that I'm not into this dichotomy between the humanities.
I hate
and science.
It. I hate it, and you know I hate it. You know that we should be going back to an educational system that doesn't draw these diversions. Because your own interests were science and, you
well,
know,
I think,
you crossed
I think,
over,
look,
didn't
I mean,
you?
I think that, you know, there is a way of knowing stuff.
Mm.
And the way of knowing stuff is, the best way of knowing stuff, to my mind, is fundamentally scientific. But that doesn't exclude history because it's evidence-based, right?
Of course.
And it doesn't matter what your evidence is.
It depends on historical study.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, the only reason me and you are talking now is because it happens to be that my discipline ended up being a historical source when no one was really anticipating that happening.
It's beautiful and it's wonderful. I think that the idea that that more of these communications happen is a really important thing. And Adam Rutherford, before we collapse, I think we should probably call our podcast to an end. Dear Art Detective listeners, this has been a secret treat on the Patreon site. For those of you who have very kindly and graciously decided to support our podcast. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I mean, I don't normally drink.
Inordinate amounts of drink.
Well, the Chambly was fine. The rum and coke that you just gave me.
I just gave you a
that killer. was surprising.
Excellent. How can people follow you and what's your latest book and what should they do?
Know.
Come on, this is your plug.
They can find me. I'm too tired and too drunk.
He's at Dr. Adam Rutherford on Twitter. He has a brilliant new book called The Book of Humans.
Yeah, you have to look at the title.
Tons of love. Thanks for all your support, and I'll speak to you in a more sober state soon. Right.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.